Hey, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. One more week on News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. Joining me in the studio, Paula Levine. We have a really important program for you today, talking about the issue that everyone is talking about. Will the United States go to war with Syria? Is the case a solid one? Is the opposition to it growing and mounting? Is the media doing its job in covering this conflict? We'll be talking about that in our first segment with Professor Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco. He's the head of their chairman of the Middle East Studies Department there, and also with Greg Mitchell, formerly with editor and publisher, now with The Nation magazine, who's been writing the media blog, monitoring media coverage, first of the Iraq War and now of the impending conflict with Syria. So we'll hear about all of that. And in the second segment, we'll be talking about a new book about the D.B. Cooper case. You may remember the man who jumped out of a plane, with a parachute and disappeared from view and has been, you know, hunted ever since. And then we'll hear from Glenn Greenwald. So there's a lot coming up on News Dissector Radio.
Running down the desert in a Hummer.
Based on the Humvee used by the U.S. military. It is one smooth ride. And being so high up above everyone else, everyone gets out of your way. You've got a great view of the road. But that sense of empowerment doesn't come cheap. The Hummer only gets about 12 miles to the gallon.
What about Al Jazeera in that, publishing those gruesome pictures of dead soldiers?
I think there's something that is culturally Arab about that.
You know, I'm looking forward to some tapes of dead people. Osama bin Laden dead, Saddam Hussein dead. I'd certainly put those on Fox News.
And that's Special Report for this time. News, fair, balanced, and unafraid.
Media war.
All wars are media wars, and we're going to be hearing more about that now. Greg Mitchell is in the studio. Didn't get to chat with you before the program, Greg, but you're doing a media blog for The Nation now. You've been following this media coverage. What's your take on it? Is it totally pro-war, or has the fact that there's a strong opposition among the right and the left in America changing the way the media covers this?
Well, thanks for having me on. If Obama had decided to attack a week ago on his own, which people thought possible, I think we could have clearly said that the media fell down to that point. But just having this extra week, and now it'll be more than a week, of the congressional debate has given the media a chance to get going, to take a harder look. And so we have just in the last few days finally seen more questioning, more tough articles. The New York Times today on its front page, after really not focusing at all for the past 10 days on who we actually would be aiding in Syria, finally came out with the top front page story and top front page photo, showing I think they turned it brutality of the rebels there, actually showing an execution in, or mass execution in progress, and the story that went with it was very tough about.
Well, this sort of stuff is really hot and heavy, on Fox and on Glenn Beck's network. He's showing videos of Syrian rebels eating the hearts of dead Syrian soldiers. I mean, it's a high emotional content, a high dramatic content, lots of warnings. Don't watch this video. Now watch this kind of thing. Steve Zunis is with us from San Francisco. A lot of what's happening now is a debate about the chemical weapons. Did the Syrians attack their own people with chemical weapons, or did the rebels do it, or do we know who did it? Will we ever know who did it? You've been following this chemical weapon issue for many, many years. What do we need to know to really understand what's going on here?
Well, the most important thing to know is who did it. I do think the preponderance of evidence is that the August 21st attack was indeed done by the Syrian regime, primarily to clear a rebel stronghold near the capital. That was of strategic importance. They've been unable to dislodge otherwise. Of course, the vast majority of people killed were not rebel soldiers, but innocent civilians, including hundreds of children. The unfortunate reality is that very few people trust the U.S. government around this question of chemical weapons. I mean, it's ironic that President Obama has dispatched Vice President Biden and Secretary of State Kerry as the ones to really press the issues, address this issue, to make the case for war, saying we have all this incontrovertible evidence that the government was behind the attacks. When Kerry and Biden, you know, just 10 years ago or 11 years ago, were saying, oh, we have this incontrovertible evidence that Iraq still has chemical weapons, and Kerry is even saying they had even more chemical weapons than they had before the Gulf War, when in fact they eliminated them all 10 years earlier. Similarly, Nancy Pelosi saying that the evidence is undeniable, whereas, again, 11 years ago she was saying there's no question that Saddam has chemical weapons.
Well, I mean, Putin is raising a question whether you like him or not. He's saying, okay, you guys have evidence, you have proof, let us see it. Give it to the UN. Let us examine it. And what's interesting is that the demand for the evidence seems to be coming to from a government that's kind of involved in this conflict, albeit on the Syrian side, but it's not coming from the news media, Greg. In other words, why isn't there an uproar in the news media demanding that the U.S. government reveal this evidence?
Well, I hope we're transitioning to that now. A week ago, the media accepted without question the John Kerry's numbers about the number of dead there, for exactly 1,429, including, you know, exactly 435 children. Now they're starting to question it or add things like and point out that all other sources point to much lower numbers. So that's a good step, but they're not really looking at, you know, what the actual true numbers are, what the U.S. is basing its intelligence on. And, the thing is, Kerry, I wrote a piece today asking whether Kerry, in fact, is as bad or at least as bad as Colin Powell at the U.N., because he seems to be either lying or misleading with information, including, you know, not only the claims about the number killed, but the claims that this is not really war. You know, this is not an act of war. It's not war. He said it, 150 times. It seems like every time he speaks, there's more questions about whether he's actually deliberately misleading the public. You know, he said early on that there's no sense of the UN going in there because all the traces of the chemicals would be gone in 4 days, and so it was worthless, which was completely false. And I'm sure he knew that.
It seems like statements coming from all sides, from all places, are just being tossed randomly in the air. I mean, I was looking at that Times article today and the picture on the front, and it turns out that the opposition is killing people in this war. They're brutally murdering the enemy, you know, as though
war. Big Reuters story today I would point people to about that. And again, there, if you read between the lines, Reuters is saying that Kerry is basically lying when he's telling Congress all week that the most of the rebels are moderates and that the moderate faction is growing. And, Reuters says, it's simply not true. And why would Kerry even be claiming that?
Well, Steve, you in an earlier statement that you made, you talked about how in 2007, Syria, which was then a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council, introduced a draft resolution to create a weapons of mass destruction free zone for the entire Middle East, but the United States blocked it, and that would have addressed not just various chemical weapons in Syria itself, but also weapons and nuclear weapons in Egypt, rather in Israel. The nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons that the Israelis have, and Egypt's chemical weapons as well. So is this a selective kind of focus in much of our media about chemical weapons? Do you think they know much about chemical weapons in the Middle East?
I mean, obviously, with a lot of arms control issues, you know, there tends to be a rejection of the idea that arms control needs to be based on universal principles, and instead it becomes one that's used for geopolitical or ideological purposes. The reason that Syria has chemical weapons, has chemical weapons in the first place, is a response to Israel's development of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons in the 1960s. And the disarmament resolution 687 with Iraq basically said that the disarmament of Iraq would be the first step towards region-wide disarmament of non-conventional weapons. And so the Syrians tried to put together this resolution that would reinforce it. It had widespread support, but due to a threatened U.S. veto, it was tabled. Because, you know, which is quite frustrating. Then you have, of course, the fact that when Iraq did use chemical weapons on a massive scale during the Iran-Iraq war, you had officials from the Defense Intelligence Agency on the ground in Baghdad passing on U.S. satellite footage to the Iraqi military to show them where concentrations of Iranian troops were, in the full knowledge they're going to use chemical weapons to attack them. And indeed, the chemical weapons themselves, a number of the key components, came from U.S. shipments of fertilizers and pesticides, which, according to congressional hearings in the mid-1990s, it was revealed the Reagan administration knew that they were being transferred for military purposes, but turned a blind eye.
Yeah, Foreign Policy magazine recently, just to interrupt for a second, had an interesting article about a CIA report of some kind that actually confirmed that, you know, there was a joke in those days, Greg, you'll recall, you know, how do we know that they have these weapons? Because we have the receipts of having sold them to them. You know, so the question here is the United States in a moral position to make a big judgment about Syria when it supplied these chemical weapons to Iraq and to many other countries?
Well, of course, exactly. Go on.
Just to say that we really have no moral standing in being the big enforcer on the question of chemical weapons, but also I want to emphasize we don't have a legal standing either. This is a violation. What Syria has apparently done is a violation, a very, very gross violation of international law. But a unilateral military attack would also be a gross violation of international law, and because such force can only be authorized by the United Nations Security Council. And so this kind of self-righteous thing that we alone among the 193 nations of the world, perhaps in conjunction with France, can somehow enforce Syria's violation through unilateral military action makes mockery, and not just of this sense of moral standing, but of having legal standing either.
You were saying, Greg? I'm sorry.
Well, you know, people are going back to, in terms of our moral standing and legal standing. Of course, going back to the use of napalm in Vietnam and, supplying Israel with, white phosphorus and cluster bombs and so forth. I go back to, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as you know. It's a subject I've written about for decades. In the United States, for example, Hiroshima, most people still don't have a big problem with that. But around the world, and it's the usual way, Americans are unable to imagine how people around the world view things differently. And certainly Hiroshima would be a prime example of how the people of the world remember it, and remember other transgressions by the United States in the past decades. It's not just history to them. It makes them take whatever the U.S. says in these realms with a big grain of salt.
Well, it's part of our history, Greg, too. You know, the Declaration of Independence included the lines, with a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. And that was one of the principles, in a way, of the American Revolution. It's not something that's a foreign concept here, but they tend to make it that way in the way they cover the world in terms of us versus them a lot of the times.
Well, I think that, you can debate, and there will be debated about the extent of the chemical attack there, and what's the proof, and so on and so forth. But even if people agreed that the attack took place, it killed a large number of people, the Assad government, 99% for sure did it, the question would still be how to respond. How do you not make things worse? And that's where the debate has come down to, you know, it's come down to now, that even if you are morally outraged and condemning it as, you know, as strongly as you possibly could, it comes down to how do you respond without making things worse, maybe a lot worse. And so I think that's what the question has come down to.
You know, we seem to be stuck in a diversion here, you know, talking about, you know, the moral premise behind going in there. And that's really not why we're going in at all. You know, I don't think the media is discussing what those reasons are. And of course, they're not being stated. I assume it has something to do with Israel, and I assume it has something to do with contractors.
It's a three-letter word, Polar. Three letters beginning with O and ending with L.
Oh, I thought you were going to say self-hating Jew.
No, oil, and pipeline politics. There's a lot about that going factored in here that is not being reported. It's being reported in Asia Times. It's being reported in other outlets around the world, but not in the United States. Greg, what is the antipathy among the American media to simply, like, want to get the evidence from the government? I mean, there was a long article in the New York Times that pointed out, you know, we said so many dead. They said another country said so many fewer dead. But all these differences don't really matter in the end because there were still people who died. You know, in other words, don't let the facts get in the way of a good argument.
Right. Well, that is. The media really has, I've mentioned other ways they've fallen down, but the lack of just outrage and demanding, you know, evidence. How, you know, now we know some things have to be kept secret, and we don't expect you know, everything to be released. But, you know, it's amazing. It's sort of, it's taken Dennis Kucinich, you know, had a web posting today where he posed like 50 questions that really got to the heart of where did this come from? You know, just basic, not saying, hey, give us away all the military and government secrets, but just very basic things. You said this. Where did that come from? What are you basing that on? You know, and I think that's the problem, and that's where the media. And again, I think enough time has passed that you're getting more of that, and I think you will get more of it. But you know, as often the case, you say. It sort of took John Stewart a couple nights ago to be the one who expressed in about 5 minutes the real absurdity of the claims and the lack of tough response to them.
Well, the latest absurdity, I don't know, Steve, you may have another one to throw into the pot here, but the latest one that I saw was yesterday. Hagel said, "Oh, this will take millions of dollars." You know, not, when asked how much would this cost, he said maybe tens of millions of dollars. He was kind of a little vague about it. Then the White House issued a statement, said, no, we have enough money in the budget right now that could cover it. In other words, in the bloated Pentagon budget. Then today, Kerry has said, well, the Arab governments are going to pay for it.
Right, until the first American plane gets shot down.
What do you say about that? How can we even get a realistic estimate of what this is going to cost? I know when they allocate resources, somebody's keeping, you know, tabs on how much it all costs.
I remember going up to the Iraq War. Bush administration officials were saying that, you know, the occupation would pay for itself, and now the Arab governments would chip in. It really wouldn't cost Americans much, and so far it's cost us $1 trillion. And when you count the interest of the national debt, veterans benefit, and everything else, it's going to probably be $3 trillion eventually. I mean, both in terms of material cost and human cost and everything else, it's very difficult to keep a war limited because there are almost always consequences, unforeseen circumstances. And, you know, I looked at the, you know, when I look at strategic calculations, I mean, how is this going to actually work? I mean, put aside the moral arguments, put aside the legal arguments, even put aside the financial arguments for a moment.
Okay, I'm putting those aside. Go ahead. What should we focus on?
Will this be an effective deterrent against future use of chemical weapons? Will it ease the suffering? Would it make an easier transition to a democratic, stable Syria? And every scenario I see, I really don't see how it can possibly be done. And the And I guess it's theoretically possible you could make it punishing enough to lead to compromise, but not so bad as to invite retaliation, escalation. But, you know, that's pretty darn hard to calibrate. I really don't think that it's possible. And,
well, this is going to be a limited. I repeat after me, Stephen. I don't think you've been following the message points. This is going to be a limited operation, okay?
Right.
Mr. Hayden, the former CIA director who now works for Chertoff and Associates. Chertoff was the head of the Homeland Security, you'll recall, the federal judge, kind of wacky member of the Federalist Society, who now is cashing in on his contacts in Homeland Security. Anyway, Hayden was saying, this is going to be, I'll sum it up for you this way, he said, one and done. You know, there's going to be one.
Well,
meanwhile, Senate, let me just finish up for a second. The Senate then, in their resolution, is giving the government 60 days of bombing, essentially. How limited is it?
And ordering that we strongly arm the rebels and change the momentum of there, I think, is the exact wording.
Do you think any of those goals are actually being discussed, you know, by Obama and the cabinet and the Joint Chiefs?
I think Obama has bungled this so badly. I mean, his one chance to have sort of a one and done scenario, which maybe even is what he actually prefers, you know, would be if he had taken as most presidents have, if last week he had said ordered a 1 day or 2 day air, you know, a shock and awe kind of one night or two nights. A lot of stuff blown up, maybe very, very few civilians killed. And then you could say, okay, we've hit them back. That's going to cost them Syria a lot of money to rebuild those military facilities. They've gotten the message that they can't use chemical weapons. And it's only going to take a day or so. And so we're not going to get massive retaliation from them. And it's over and done with. And then, of course, right-wingers would complain we didn't do enough and so forth. But it'd be over and done with, and maybe there wouldn't be blowback right away.
Look at John McCain.
He's gotten into the weeds of the conservatives demanding that we come in and basically, you know, get rid of Assad, stay in there for weeks, and now you've got a major, major operation, which is, you know, 500 times more dangerous.
The latest plus 60 days plus an option for another 30.
Yeah, I'll take the option, please. Option Z, please. The latest report is that President Obama has canceled his visit to Los Angeles because there's a lot of no votes expected in Congress, and they're really working hard, working the phones, working the Hill. And it's not when we say working the phones, it's not just like one guy in the White House making calls. They've got phone banks of people, lobbyists from AIPAC, for example, working the phones and working the Hill. They have people from the military-industrial complex, military suppliers who want to blow stuff up so they can replace it, working the phones. This is a major push for this war. It's not just a push. You know, they go to a congressman. They say, hey, Congressman Polar Levine, you're the congressman from Tribeca here in New York City. And, you know, it's all well and good for you to oppose this. But what about the people who are doing jobs for American companies in your district, et cetera, and so forth? In other words, the pressure is on to try to, you know, sell this, war. And they're going to sell it, in my opinion, unless something dramatic happens to stop them. And in a way, just the fact that there is a debate at all, which is something they didn't want, is forcing the media to actually prolong its conversation about the underlying issues. Do you agree, Greg?
Yeah, I think that's healthy in that sense. But we've seen today. What's interesting is a week ago the polls were moving. They sort of said most Americans opposed moving and doing anything against Syria. And then when there were reports of the chemical attacks and Kerry made his big speech and Obama made his big speech, the polls started to go in the other direction. And people said, well, okay, now that people fully know more about the situation and the use of chemical weapons, they're going to come out strongly for an attack. But what's happened this week is it's the exact opposite. The more people have learned about this, the more they've learned about the dangers, it's going dramatically in the other direction. And so many congressmen are reporting today just 10-1, 100-1, 1,000-1 opposition in the messages to their offices. So, you know, I think normally you'd feel this lobbying that's going on is going to produce a yes vote, but the opposition is so strong, I mean, amazingly strong, it's going to be tough.
And the Pope has said nope, opposing it, and so has Secretary General Bond. Steve, is there a way out of here?
Well, I think a couple things. One is that we're seeing a lot of mainstream opposition to this. I mean, the International Crisis Group, which is about as mainstream as you can get. I mean, this is an international group. Thomas Pickering, a veteran U.S. diplomat, State Department official, is currently the head of it. It's made up of all these, big-time former diplomats, strategic analysts, et cetera. You know, they came out with a very, very strong statement on pragmatic grounds, citing primarily the risk of escalation, that this cannot stay limited. You have the Arab League, you have the Turks, you know, who have been arming and supporting the opposition. Even they are quite reticent about U.S. intervention. There's more international opposition to a U.S. attack on Syria than there was at the start of the Iraq War. France is the only country, it appears, that's going to contribute militarily to the operation. So the U.S. is incredibly isolated. And meanwhile, you have this interesting left-right opposition emerging domestically. I think we actually have a chance to stop this thing. I put it as less than even, but I think we actually have a chance because of this kind of isolation and. Obama, despite his many faults, is fairly pragmatic.
What's your prediction, Greg Mitchell of The Nation?
My prediction a week ago was less than even we'd be able to stop it, but now I think it's better than even, just because I think Congress will prevent it, or the Congress will not go along with it, and then it'll be thrown back to Obama, and of course he may take, as I said earlier, a more modest strike on his own. He may do nothing. He may do the massive strike.
Yeah, I mean, he's already said that he's not going to be swayed by whatever the Congress says, which is not exactly a dramatic statement of faith in democracy, is it? Anyway, guys, thank you so much for joining us and puzzling over this conundrum, situation that everybody is talking about, and I'm happy that you could be here to talk about it with us here on News Dissector Radio. We hope you'll check back in with us, and we'll check back in with you. Greg Mitchell's new media blog is on nation.com. You should check it out. Stay with us.
The fabulous Polarity One. Actually, it's Audioplasm with Polarity One and Rubio. Bob Smith of the FBI, and the content was a cassette that I got a hold of surreptitiously from Danny Schechter from 1973, when his house was raided by the FBI, specifically Bob Smith of the FBI.
Well, that's a good setup maybe for the next segment here. We're talking about the FBI. We're going to be talking with another Mr. Smith about an investigation he's been doing into an investigation of the disappearance, the mystery, shall we say, of D.B. Cooper, who was somebody who fell out of a plane or jumped out of a plane and jumped into history and into the mystery of conspiracy law. Introduce yourself and the book and whatnot.
Thank you, Danny. My name is Bruce Smith, and you've hit the nail on the head. It's history and it's mystery. The D.B. Cooper case happened about 41 years ago, the night before Thanksgiving in 1971, and it ranks as the top 10 of true crime mysteries of American law. D.B. Cooper was one of the first skyjackers. There were many skyjackers back in that era who were flying, you know, fly me to Cuba. It was all political. But D.B. Cooper was one of the first extortionists, and he said, give me the money and I'll give you back the plane. Basically, along with 36 passengers and the crew. And he'd also demanded $200,000. He skyjacked a plane on takeoff in Portland, Oregon, that was en route to SeaTac at Seattle, Washington. And they made the exchange. He got the money. He got four parachutes, and they took off, and he said, fly me to Mexico at 10,000 feet. And he gave the pilots a lot of specific metrics on how to fly the plane. He didn't want to go over 10,000 feet. He wanted the plane not to be over 200 miles an hour. He wanted the landing gears locked and down. He wanted the flap set at 15 degrees. And the pilot who was, the guy who was flying the plane, a pilot by the name of Bill Radicek, told me, he says, when he said set the flaps at 15 degrees, I knew I was dealing with a smart cookie. Because the 727 that D.B. Cooper was stealing was the only Boeing product that had a predetermined setting in the cockpit for 15 degrees. So Cooper clearly knew what he was talking about. And as it turns out, those kinds of metrics were top secret information at that time in 1971 and only known to a handful of Boeing officials and to top secret commanders in the Vietnam theater.
So then what happens with D.B. Cooper?
So D.B. Cooper's flying. He's 30 miles. He's 30 minutes out of SeaTac Airport. He sends his one hostage, a flight attendant, to the cockpit. And a few minutes later, there is what the FBI has determined is a pressure bump. So the 727 was the only plane at its time, or one of the few planes in that era, that had its own staircase. That was part of the plane. So the staircase got lowered down into the slipstream. The pilots didn't even know that they could fly the plane with the aft stairs down. And it is believed that D.B. Cooper walked down those stairs and jumped into history and into the mystery. He's never been seen again. No evidence, physical evidence, was ever found to this day. His identity is not known. And the only thing that was ever discovered was $5,800 in a stack of three bundles that was located 8 years later by a boy on a beach on the Columbia River downstream from Portland, Oregon. And the question is, how did it get there? When did it get there? And
they linked it to the...
Yes, the serial numbers linked up. It's confirmed that they were part of the ransom money. And to this day, the FBI has not publicly released any information that would suggest...
What did the FBI do, though, in the aftermath of this? Was it a massive manhunt, wasn't it? I mean,
well, yes and no. And that's what my book is about. What did the FBI do? And when did they do it? Is there anybody around that can tell me some of the details? And my book is half about the actual crime. So it's a comprehensive study of who's who and what's what with the crime. And then it really focuses in what did the FBI do? And my perspective is that the FBI, their response to D.B. Cooper was hit and miss. One thing I've learned is that in my book, I specifically state, I don't know if it's a cover-up or a conspiracy, but I'm here to tell you that there are plenty of individuals within the FBI who screwed up. They lost evidence. They didn't share evidence. They didn't share information. And it's clear to me that the FBI, the agents, do not play well with others. They certainly don't talk to guys like me or other journalists, and they don't even talk to themselves. And it's clear that the problems that the FBI had with 9/11 were evident 30 years before in the D.B. Cooper case. You have a complex case, multi-jurisdictions, FBI bungles it. And I believe that D.B. Cooper survived the case, and the FBI has been doing a spin job. It is my...
Didn't they say that they believe he died in the...
That's the current view of the FBI, and it's been pretty... well documented.
Do they have a high degree of confidence in this formulation?
They speak with confidence, but there are no facts. There's no body. There's no physical evidence that Cooper died. And you can play it the other way.
We're getting some kind of weirdness
here.
Maybe it's D.B. Cooper. I don't know.
I don't know. It's the FBI.
He's surfacing.
I think it was Bob Smith who bungled it.
There we go. Bob is back. Okay.
It's a fascinating, fascinating story. So you've written a full book about it called?
It's called Sky Thief, A Report on the D.B. Cooper Investigation.
And so if anyone publishing is listening, this is a great book looking for a publisher, and it's a story that has a tremendous audience already.
I agree.
This is something that I think is probably a big on the Internet hit list of people who want to know more about D.B. Cooper.
I'll take it one step further, Danny. If anybody would like to be part of my beta testing crew, I will give them a digital copy of my book as it is right now. So I'm looking for an agent, and I'm looking for a publisher. But if you would like to read my story right now, I will trust you as long as you give me some feedback and help me with the typos and things like that. And you can send it to brucesmith@rainierconnect.com, or you can reach me through my online news magazine, which is the Mountain News, washington.net.
There you go. Yeah. A free book and also a great story. And it's an interesting story because you begin it by talking about what drove you to investigate it. And in a way, it's because it happened right over you where you live, right?
Right. I grew up in New York on Long Island, and I moved in 1990 to the Northwest. And I was a newspaper reporter in the Tacoma area, and I was covering an air show. And I met a pilot who had a beautifully restored Fairchild 24, which as a kid, I had built the balsa wood model of the plane. It was the first time I'd ever seen the real plane. We started talking, and it was a hot day, and we're sitting in the shade under one of the wings, and he gave me a ice-cold Coke, and there was a book on the ground that said D.B. Cooper, blah, blah, blah. And I said, hey, you're into D.B. Cooper? And he says, hell yeah, I just wrote that book. And so we spent the rest of the day, and he told me about the book, and it was a confession that a friend of his had given to him and a number of other pilots from that little private airstrip near Puyallup, Washington. And I saw so many inconsistencies in the story that he was telling me of the FBI's investigation, that's what piqued my interest, and so that's what got me started in 2008.
So, I mean, as an investigative reporter myself, often, you know, there is often a personal passion in pursuing a subject, and you seem to certainly have one about this case. What have you learned that has really surprised you so far?
Everything about the case that I've touched has mystery to it. There's missing evidence. There's a missing FBI agent. There's a murder. The FBI's de facto technical expert on the parachutes got murdered in April in his house in Woodinville, Washington, and the cops are totally mum on it, and they won't talk to me about nothing on it. You mentioned one and done before, and I use that phrase in my book because that's very much the hallmark of my experience with D.B. Cooper and law enforcement. This book really sets a tone of how law enforcement really functions in the United States, and their primary job is not to catch criminals or to fight crime. Their primary job is to protect the powerful and to tell bedtime stories to everyone so we can sleep at night with some plausible explanations of the crimes that happened that day and we saw in the 11 o'clock news. And
So they're like spinsters.
They're spinsters. They're spin stories. Yeah, they're spinmeisters. And when it comes to FBI guys, when I talk to them, they tell me their story, their prepared narrative. It's almost scripted. They can say it with two hands tied behind their back.
Message points.
Yeah, and then when I start asking them leading questions, they've never met a reporter like me before. And I hit them blindside, and they are angry at me, and they don't return phone calls, and they hang up, and I'm one and done. That's what I call the FBI's response to me, is one and done. The last agent I talked to said, I've never had my integrity questioned before. Well, in reality, he's never had an investigative reporter talk to him before.
The investigators don't like investigative reporters, I'm
They
sure.
don't. They hate us.
Is this disillusioning to you, Polar, to hear that the FBI, in which you have so much respect and put so much stock, may screw up from...
Well, it's disillusioning to know that Cooper only asked for $200,000.
Well, that was back in 1971.
Yeah, but still.
It wasn't a lot of money in 1971, and it's worth about $1 million today, which is kind of like Bupkis. But he had a problem. How much money can you jump and parachute with? The $200,000 was delivered to him in 20s, and he may have had an inside knowing of what kind of money he was going to be getting, because the FBI had just begun stockpiling bundles of hundreds of thousands of dollars in its field offices and banks, anticipating this kind of crime, because they didn't want a hostage situation to develop. And they say, well, you know, the banks are closed until Monday at 9 a.m. You know, would you like pizza in the meantime? And hold on to like 50 or 60 people at gunpoint for a couple of days. You know, it's like, you know, it's...
Well, that's a fascinating aspect of the case as well. And how the FBI prepares, anticipates that certain crimes will take place and how they're going to respond to that.
Right. And Cooper had done this crime on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. So hostages potentially were going to wait for 4 days before they saw the light of day if the feds couldn't give him the money right away. So it was very insightful for the FBI in that regard. And then there's some question, did D.B. Cooper actually know what the FBI was doing?
So one more time, let's give your email to people listening.
My email address is brucesmith@rainierconnect.com. Rainier Connect is like the mountain, R-A-I-N-I-E-R, and Connect is normal spelling, C-O-N-N-E-C-T.com.
Well, I'll tell you, I've started to read it. It's really well written, Bruce. I'm really happy that you called me out of the blue, and, you know, I was certainly new about this issue, this mystery, and I was so happy that you could be here, because you're not on the East Coast very much, I'm told, and I'm glad that you're here with us and talking with us. And in a way, this is a segue. This is one man's investigative reporting who's actually been following a story for years, tracking down the people involved, tracking down the FBI, trying to find out what has not been said about it. And now we segue to the case of perhaps one of the most well-known examples of whistleblowing today, investigative reporting involving Ed Snowden, the former NSA technical technician who worked for private businesses in the big spy syndrome. And there was just an event in the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung Polar, the foundation in Germany, honored him with a Whistleblower of the Year award. And Glenn Greenwald, who has done, you know, a lion's share of the work in actually publicizing and analyzing and offering and reporting on what Snowden's revelations are, was asked to comment on the award to Ed Snowden, and it's on YouTube, but I listened to it today. It's extremely brilliant. It seems to be improvised by Glenn Greenwald. Glenn was on this show a few months ago. He's a brilliant journalist. He's a lawyer. He now works with The Guardian newspaper, and he's at the center of many, many different controversies, including the recent case in London where his friend, boyfriend, was captured in England with information and documents. Now, some people from the UN are saying that the British government has acted improperly in seizing and the way they've treated him. At any rate, here he is, Glenn Greenwald, commenting on Edward Snowden. Listen to this.
I'm really delighted to be able to speak about the whistleblower award that has been given to Edward Snowden. If I were on the committee making the choice of who was to receive this award, it would take me probably 1.5 seconds at most to have come to the conclusion that he's the only person deserving of this award for this year, because he really does embody whistleblowing in its purest and most noble form. There's a lot of debate about what whistleblowing means, what exactly the attributes are that defines it, and I've written a lot about whistleblowing and have thought a lot about it, and I think that there's two real components to whistleblowing. One is the disclosure of wrongdoing, serious wrongdoing on the part of powerful factions. And the second one is to disclose that wrongdoing at some risk to yourself. So I think if you look at what the two criteria, the defining criteria are, he embodies both of those as purely as one can imagine. He exposed enormous amounts of wrongdoing on the part of the world's most powerful factions. He informed the world that there is a massive, ubiquitous spying system being constructed by the United States and its closest allies, aimed not at the terrorists or at criminals or people for whom there's evidence to suspect wrongdoing, but at all of us, people around the world. And I think the most significant revelation of what it is that he disclosed is that literally the objective of the United States and its closest allies in the UK, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia is the elimination of privacy globally, meaning the idea that there will be no ability on the part of any human beings to communicate with one another electronically without it being monitored, collected, analyzed, and stored by the United States government. One of the most profound revelations, I think, in the political landscape in some time. He also revealed enormous amounts of deceit on the part of the most senior national security officials, including deceit that is almost certainly criminal. High-level Obama officials going to the United States Congress and denying to the Congress that the NSA is doing exactly that which these revelations prove that they are doing. And so when you look at the combination of this invasive, massive spying system operating with almost no transparency or accountability and the systematic lying on the part of senior Obama officials to the democratic institutions designed to check that, the amount of wrongdoing, the seriousness of it, that he revealed to the world is as significant as it gets. The second attribute, which is the notion that you revealed this wrongdoing at some degree of risk to yourself, self-evidently, is something that Edward Snowden embodies as much as, if not more than anybody we've seen in a long time. I still remember so vividly the very first conversation I had with him in Hong Kong when I asked him whether or not he had thought about the likely consequences of his actions. And with very stoic and rational demeanor, he ticked off one after the next all of the things that he knew were likely to happen to him that have now in fact happened to him, including being charged as a criminal under the Espionage Act, an incredibly draconian law that threatens people with prison for decades, that he would be publicly branded as a traitor and someone who has gravely damaged national security, and that in essence he would become the single most wanted man in the world by the world's most powerful government. And yet he undertook this course of action knowing that all of those things were likely to happen, because he told me in good conscience he could not sit by quietly and allow privacy and internet freedom to be destroyed while doing nothing about it. And he did it not only anticipating the risk, but knowing that they were almost certain to come and embracing them to such an extent that he was one of the calmest people I've ever interacted with, even as the anxiety and tension levels ought to have been through the roof given the extremity of a situation. But he was so convinced about the rightness of what he was doing that this equanimity had prevailed over him, and yet he was fully aware of the risks he was taking and yet took it anyway for the public good, which to me is also as pure a whistleblower as it gets. Ultimately, though, I think that what will end up being most significant and most enduring about the whistleblowing of Edward Snowden is not the specific information we end up learning about what the United States and its allies are doing in destroying privacy worldwide, nor will it be the truths about the U.S. media and the world media and their relationship to political power and the way they've allowed these systems to go undetected and unreported for so many years until he had the courage to step forward. I think what will be really most enduring is the lesson that he has taught all of us, the lesson about the power of a single individual to change the world, literally, through nothing more than a powerful choice. Edward Snowden, 3 months ago, was as ordinary of a person as it gets. He was born into no positions of wealth or power. His parents are middle class or lower employees of the federal government. He had no positions of prestige or special access of any kind. He grew up in a lower middle class background, was just a low-level employee of a national security state when he first entered it. And yet, through the choice that he made, he has literally radically transformed how we understand our relationship to political power, what the position of the United States government is vis-a-vis the entire world. He has triggered massive debates all over the planet about the importance of internet freedom and privacy and the dangers and menace posed by the U.S. surveillance state. Really, a single individual who just on his own made a choice that had extreme ripple effects on all sorts of realms that I think to this day are still underappreciated and unknown. And this lesson that any individual, no matter how formidable the adversary seems, no matter how entrenched the oppressive institution appears to be, can stand up to that institution and challenge it and shine light on it and bring about real change, I think is a lesson that all kinds of people around the world, from very young to very old, from every continent in the earth, will take from this. And there will be untold numbers of people who will be inspired by the courage of Edward Snowden, by the sacrifice that he engaged in, by the principle stand that he took, by the passion and conviction that drove him to do what he did. And it very well may be the case that of all the impact that his conduct ends up having, what he actually ends up revealing will be a small part historically of what we end up learning when we look at all the people who end up inspired by him to come forward, and journalists who end up unafraid to challenge the world's most powerful factions, people being willing to risk all sorts of public smear campaigns and threats of imprisonment and stigmatization and demonization because they saw that Edward Snowden and the people who worked with him were willing to endure that and to see the enormous amounts of good that they achieved and deciding that they too are willing to do it. So it isn't just the whistleblowing or the risk that he undertook personally that I think will be the most enduring impact of what it is that he did. I think it will be the template that he created, the inspiration that he provided for other people all over the world in all kinds of different realms to do the same. And I think the reason to award whistleblowing and to honor it and to give an award to whistleblowing isn't merely to give that individual the recognition that they are due, but also to send a signal to the world that whistleblowing is something that we honor and that we celebrate. Because
yes, yes, yes. Wow, wow, wow. Glenn Greenwald, yeah. Speaking, I think, from Brazil, from his home. You could hear his dogs in the background. I found that very endearing. But speaking with great eloquence and not reading his remarks, just making them up on the spot. And I thought it was an extremely interesting assessment of Snowden by the person who's been, in essence, also taking great risks.
Indeed.
To bring Snowden's information to the public and has been denounced and attacked by many as well. So
yeah, apparently Brazil now is ticked off at our government for doing that, apparently, to their government. They were spying on the Brazilian government.
Yeah, and Snowden revealed that and Greenwald reported it. So it's a good way to end the program this week. Let's hope that war with Syria will be averted. We'll know more, obviously, next week. Please follow my blog at newsdissector.net. I'm covering all the sources that I can find with articles about this conflict from various points of view. Mediachannel.org is also doing the same and with a tremendous range of diverse views about the media. So please check that out as well. This is a Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM.
And you can get more Polarity One music on PolarityOne.com.
There you go. We're going to go out with one of his songs, which is a song about the news business. Thank you, Polarity One. Thank you, Heather. Thank you, PRN, and everyone for listening. We'll be back next week.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning Sandy Station carries no news of the world.
So is the news of the people left out? Put a camera in my face just to hear me shout. But they don't want to hear what I shout about. You love it with my cup, but not a people rebuff. We never play the lead in the sitcom you call the news. Unless we're accused, positive refuse. The point I'm